Well, hello. My name is Chip Spear, and you're listening to Earth Plus 30, a podcast where we talk about the goals, the issues, the plans, and the strategies of the Earth 30 years from today. There are many, many different issues about the future that we could talk about. Today, specifically, I want to talk about water. One of my neighbors, Mark Robert, is chief operating officer of an investment firm called Water Asset Management. He also is president of the board of trustees of a nonprofit called Water Aid America, which is the American branch of an international organization called Water Aid. They specifically deal with clean water, decent toilets, and hygiene education to help people in third world countries have better access and better understand the challenges of water. Mark's a fascinating guy. His knowledge is broad and deep in issues related to water. I had a couple of conversations at a few different social functions, and I thought, man, this guy would be really interesting to have on one of my podcasts. So I asked him to participate, and he said yes. So with that, I want to introduce you to Mark Robert.
Well, thank you, Chip, and appreciate the interest. Yeah, I had spent a good portion of my career working in finance. I worked for a couple of different investment banks. And in 2006, I left that world and joined up with some colleagues and friends who had identified the water sector as an area that had some interesting characteristics. One, it was a kind of a unique business model from an investment perspective in that it is largely a very monopolistic relationship between the vendor and the customer. You know, you essentially have one pipe in and one pipe out of your house. And because of the requirements of, you know, the expense and the capital required, it's very difficult to supplant that relationship. So that was, you know, sticky business model. Two, very capital intensive and generally has been underinvested in. And three, which is probably really point number one, it's a very local business. And so lots of opportunities for different investment outlooks, different ways to diversify your portfolio, although you're investing in water. So from a very high level, it struck me as an area of interest. Mm-hmm. And the more I've gotten to know it, the more I realize that this is one of the great neglected resources of our time. It is inevitably the most unique because it cannot be duplicated, cannot be replaced. It is finite. So we have the same amount of water today as we did have, you know, 50,000 years ago. And it has generally been mistreated in that we have, although we have the same amount of water, more of it is being polluted, more of it is being wasted. And the population size obviously has changed over the last several thousand years, and we are dealing with a lot more demand. So from a macro perspective, a lot of interesting elements. And then from a human element, there is a, you know, a very basic need for water, one which is taken for granted, which in the worst of circumstances can be life-threatening. Also, the wastewater element, which is another part of the water side, is probably one of the largest distributed healthcare services around the world. So the ability to take sewage or treat it or wastewater and treat it and make sure that it gets away from the population and doesn't infect people with either disease or mostly disease, it is a real, on a major scale, a very important and necessary service. So we look at this as, you know, both an interesting business opportunity, but more importantly, a very important opportunity for the globe to get this right.
So let's look at the seven areas that I picked out of your website for your company, your water asset management. And those seven areas are infrastructure, resource development, efficiency, water quality, quantity monitoring, privatization, industry consolidation, and technological change. Now, that's a lot of information.
Right.
Almost information overload to give a list like that. But maybe we can look at it from the standpoint of the infrastructure, because we see a lot of problems about moving water, about water pipes, about infrastructure in third world countries. Cape Town is running out of water, and Yemen is running out of water, and Iran is running out of water. How do they move it? How do we move it? What are we doing about that stuff? And then we can go through some of the other areas as we kind of walk through these seven.
Yeah, I think the important element I tried to point out is that water is eminently very local. So although there's plenty of water in the world, it just doesn't always happen to be where population is expanding or where growth is the greatest. So we think, and if there's some very interesting work in terms of predicting future geopolitical instability based on drought. Mm-hmm. And there are, a number of satellites which measure water, basically groundwater extraction. Areas where you have seen groundwater extraction beyond nature's ability to replace it is usually an area where you're going to see a population starting to either migrate, definitely start to see them be agitated by loss of agricultural productivity. And, essentially, you're going to see people moving into cities. You're going to see general instability. And these are great predictors for problems going forward. And, Syria was very much a byproduct of that. Iran has got some tremendous water problems. The Middle East generally has quite acute water problems. But obviously, we're seeing some of the issues in Africa. India is a disaster of epic proportions, as is Pakistan.
Yeah, I have no idea. Hmm.
Yeah, so India has, India has essentially has one of the largest populations in the world and is extracting groundwater at a rate in excess of its ability to recharge, to the point where some places groundwater levels have fallen several hundred feet. And a lot of that has been borne by the fact that the government has encouraged the use of subsidized electricity, so cheap electricity, to pump water in inefficient agriculture, because a great portion of the Indian population still lives in a rural setting. So the whole aspect of, I think, water, eminently, the issues are local. For example, for people living in the United States, we are probably one of the largest consumers on a per capita basis of water. We use about three times as much as some of our colleagues in Europe. In different parts of the states, we have either too much water or not enough. In the Northeast, we generally have too much water, and we're actually faced, our water problems are largely around quality of the infrastructure and what do we do with our wastewater. Obviously, the Southwestern United States or the Southeastern United States, there it's a question of water availability. How do we match up water supplies with the growing demand? So very much a local issue. There is no generalizable situation. But at the end of the day, the most important thing you need to have is, ideally, we should all be living in water-rich areas. To the extent that we're not, we need to be conscious of how we use the water. Most water systems are obviously buried and so therefore out of sight. They tend to be replaced on rather long cycle. So depending on the material, between 50 and 100 years, you need to replace the infrastructure because water is corrosive. And ultimately, every water system in the world, no matter how well built, will fail at some point without the proper maintenance and CapEx because of this corrosive nature. So you have a system which is continually in need of replacement. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it's quite expensive, and unfortunately, it's because it's buried, a lot of people neglect it.
It made me think about a couple of things. One, the infrastructure, and you talk about having people where there is water, and I think about the growth in the Southwest, where there's just been astronomical growth in Arizona and Nevada, Las Vegas, all those areas. And they're pumping water all over the place, very, very long distances. And you mentioned in our previous conversation about how far we pump water in California. Maybe you could go into a little detail about that and tell people, because it's rather impressive in a way.
Focusing a little bit on the states, So in the United States, although the water, and I'll focus a little bit on the West, but most of the water in the United States is actually surface water, so lakes and rivers. Groundwater has, which obviously water in aquifers below ground, is generally connected to surface water in some way, shape, or form. Many groundwater aquifers recharge quite slowly, so that if you are dependent on an aquifer, you need to be sure that you're not extracting it at a level greater than it is naturally recharging. So some of the largest aquifers in the United States, the largest, the Ogallala Aquifer, which runs sort of from North Texas all the way up to the northern central plains, is one such aquifer which is not recharging as fast as water is being extracted from it. And that is a major source of supply for the agricultural communities of, you know, that part of the world, which produces a tremendous amount of the grains and corn, soybean, wheat, and other crops for both the U.S. and export. So
I'd like to ask about that, because if that is the case, what do you do? I mean, what do all those farms do? Or long term, what's going to happen?
Well,
are people thinking about it?
You have to manage it, and you have to think of ways to recharge the aquifer, and that means extracting less. It can be also improving soil quality. You know, there's a big movement to go towards no-till, and I'll just back up a step.
Yeah.
Just so everybody understands, agriculture in the grand use of water, agriculture uses, you know, between 70% and 80% of all the water in the world.
Wow.
So to become more efficient in water, one inevitably ends up talking about agriculture and agricultural practices.
Mm-hmm.
So improving how one manages soil, you know, the idea of making your soil better able to retain moisture, so you actually need less water to irrigate it. I think the idea also of leaving a cover crop so that soils don't dry out and blow away. We're also looking at the efficiency of the, you know, what kind of crop are you growing? Is it suitable for the water situation in your particular area? So in many parts of the Southwest, you're having to manage the dynamic of population growth, which represents the large part of the economic activity.
Right.
And the obvious use of water for agriculture, which important, unfortunately, generates less than 3% of the GDP. So we're in need for greater measurement. And the word we use a lot in the water world is transparency. What is the use? Are you using water in the best way? Are you using it in a responsible way? Are you using it in a way that doesn't necessarily degrade the groundwater or the quality of the water in the streams? Because another byproduct of agriculture and man's activities is that wastewater, if not treated properly, finds its ways into streams and can have knock-on effects on people downriver. You know, we're seeing greater understanding of some cities saying, you know what, maybe it makes sense, instead of us buying a new water treatment plant, that we go upstream and we pay the farmers to better handle some of their agricultural runoff, which is impacting our feedstock for the water.
Wow.
So the water world is eminently connected. And I think when people think about the pricing of water,
right,
nobody really thinks about the externalities connected to water. So if obviously you didn't have that water, well, then you probably couldn't live where you're living. But the idea also of your improper use of water could have knock-on effect on, in the Northeast, it's you know, runoff from your lawn if you live by a stream or by the sea could have, you know, nitrogen loading impact on the local waterways, and
right,
therefore, you know, that has an impact on fish and eventually on the quality of your life. So
Yeah. These
are all interconnected elements.
So talk a little bit about the effort that's going on now in the agricultural area,
right,
and to pull those threads together so that people are being proactive, and that major corporations, these big agribusinesses, are actually starting to pay attention to that. Is that happening?
Yeah, I think they are. It depends where you live, obviously. But ultimately, we're soon going to have 9 billion people to feed. So you're going to need to figure out how do you do that. And I think also the consumer, to the extent that the middle class continues to expand, the diet is changing and requiring more proteins, typically beef, pork, and chicken, all of which can be water intensive. Beef, particularly beef fed or finished in grain, you know, in feedlots, can be very water intensive. There's a general demand for higher water intensity of input for the consumer. I'd say, look, farmers, obviously, they need to know, are they, and consumer demand is going to shape a lot of this.
Right.
Because consumers now have at their, you know, fingertips more information about how whatever product was grown. Is it GMO, non-GMO? Was it grown in a water, you know, eventually we think you're going to have a lot of information on the label. And that farmers are going to need to be much more disciplined in terms of, you know, how things are farmed, under what conditions, you know, was it responsible for the area in which it was grown? I think as an example, a lot of people, you read articles about almonds and being grown in California. And
right,
you know,
absolutely.
Rich. Yeah. Well, if you actually think about it, almonds are, so 85% of the world's almonds are grown in California. It's an area which is seeing incredible demand for almond and all its byproducts. But the return on investment for an almond farmer is quite good. It is a high-value use of the land and the water. And growing an almond is not that much more water-intensive than growing some other low-value crops.
Oh.
But because the return is high, it actually is a productive use of the water. And so ultimately, we think, and this is where our market or sort of investment background comes in, we think if you put the right price on water, people will understand how to use it better. And they'll figure out ways to conserve it. And more importantly, they'll figure out, if I'm in an area of high price for water, perhaps I should be growing something that extracts a high value for that water.
Right.
Or perhaps, and this is something we do in our business, we should consider renting the water for other uses that give, that allow for higher growth, but also importantly, give me a better return. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because it can get quite arcane, but many, with better transparency on pricing, people make better decisions.
Yeah, talk about the example that you cited to me when we were having our conversation previously before this was about Australia and how farmers are actually doing that. They're renting their water rights or whatever based on market pricing. So that was fascinating to me. So you could explain that in a little bit more detail and certainly better than I. So I asked if you could. It'd be great.
Yeah, and it's an experiment and not without a few bumps. So in eastern Australia, there's a large river system called the Murray Darling. And the Murray Darling, so Australia is the driest continent on Earth, and yet it is a major agricultural exporter. They had a period of extreme drought in the beginning of the 2000s, which prompted them to think about better ways in which to allocate water. And at the end of the day, the most important driver of a lot of this is that water was not being allocated to the environment. The government realized, we said, look, we need to make sure that the water is better shared along the system. We want to make sure there's enough water for the environment, which tended to be largely parts of the river system towards the coast where there were a lot of trees. But the idea being, if you put a price on water and you gave environment a seat at the table, and the government allowed water to trade at a price. So in essence, it was a fixed, it was sort of a cap and trade system. It was a fixed amount of water. Water in dry years sought a higher price. In wet years was at a lower price. And the government made sure that the environment got a seat at the table. So the government would go out and buy water to make sure that the environment got its share. in essence, what it did, and it allowed for farmers to realize, you know what, this water has a price, and if I get more efficient, I can get more return. So you saw a greater investment in irrigation technology and all sorts of metering technology. You also saw a change in what people were growing. If I have expensive water, I need to grow an expensive crop. So the notion of crop per drop, i.e. the dollar value of whatever the crop was grown with the same amount of water, started to go up. And it's a unique way to manage a system. If you think about it, you know, and it's obviously, it needs to be perfected. The driver for water consumption are the industries, the residents, the agriculture, and the environment. The environment usually gets left out of the equation. Municipal and industrial use is only, we're only about 10% of the equation, and agriculture is the rest. And so it was a way for them to make sure that agriculture became more economically rational. And I will tell you that, you know, it was interesting when you have a conversation with an Australian farmer and you say, what are you planting this season? The first question they'll ask you is, what in this particular region of Australia, they'll ask you, what is my price of water, before they give you an answer, which is definitely not the case here.
Oh, so true. What about in other parts of the world? Is that kind of pricing model starting to find its way into use?
No, well, it depends. So there are very few places in the world where one can actually own the right to water. There are, typically it's been Australia, the Western United States, Chile, and parts of Spain. China is actually experimenting with water rights for agricultural use as a way to make sure that their water, they're growing the right crop for the price of water or the availability of water. China is another country which is seeing a tremendous, has a very large population, has a very inequitably distributed water supply. Most of the water is in the south. Most of the population lives in the north. The country is spending tremendous amounts of money to move water around. Some people would say that China's annexation of Tibet was largely water related, because China now controls some of the largest rivers in all of Asia as a result. So in terms of better the world will need a better allocation system for water. We as consumers are going to become more and more conscious not only of the quality of the products that we consume, and that means, is the water good? I think in this country we realize that you cannot take it for granted that the municipal water supply that you drink is necessarily safe. We saw that in Flint, and there are hundreds of Flints in this country.
That's certainly not discussed at all, how pervasive that problem is.
And it's a big problem because, quite frankly, this has been an industry that's starved of capital. A lot of municipalities, 85% of all the systems in the United States, water systems, are owned by cities. Ultimately, cities have had a continually, you know, rising amount of fiscal problems, pension, healthcare, and unfortunately, sometimes the water and other infrastructure elements get pushed to the side, and water being buried underground doesn't necessarily help in terms of the visibility. So, you know, ultimately, look, we think this is a really important asset for a community. The value of having a water, a functioning water system and a functioning wastewater system, quite frankly, is more important than people realize to the viability of their local community. You know, and it needs to be recognized as such, and unfortunately, it's probably going to need to be paid for.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the balance or the different approaches with private industry to solve that problem versus municipalities, because I think that from what you explained previously, there are definitely different approaches and different types of solutions that come out of each of those two choices, right?
Yeah. I would say, look, a water system, whether it's owned by a city or a private entity, it's pretty much the same system. It's the same pipes. It's the same valves. It's the same methods of treating. The question is, how aggressive have you been in terms of maintaining that system and keeping up with the capital that is part of not only replacing, repairing, but expanding the system. And that's sort of agnostic as to owners. We would have said that, look, the private companies are more incentivized to spend on the systems and keep them upgraded as new. Depending on where you operate, many of these systems are overseen by regulators on the private side, which allow positive rates of return on investment in order to keep the investment flowing. So there's a natural incentive for the private companies to invest, whereas many of the municipal systems, same system, they may not have the same incentive, i.e. Mm-hmm. they're competing with other capital needs within the municipality's budget. And as such, they, you know, there may be the opportunity to defer some of this payment, you know, this investment, and it gets directed towards something else, which in and of itself on any given year may not be critical, but over a cumulative period of time can prove to be quite disastrous. We think ultimately there needs to be recognition that, you know, if you live in a city, these are your assets. They have, everybody focuses on the costs. Not a lot of people focus on the value that it delivers. You know, we think that it's a great asset that should be owned by, you know, long-dated capital, pension. You know, we often joke, or not joke, but remark that, you know, you go to a city, you'll meet the water manager, he'll say, I need capital. I can't get any capital because there are other constraints on the budget. You go to the guy running the local pension plan who says, I need long-dated return, visible return assets with inflation-adjusted pricing. Uh-huh. And you say, you two should meet because it's the ultimate good local investment. And so, look, we're agnostic as to who owns the asset. Mm-hmm. We just think that you know, people need to be fully aware that there are levels of underinvestment that, if pushed for long periods of time, can become life-threatening.
You mentioned, like, pension funds, which that seems like a reasonable source. What other sources do you look at from an investment standpoint, or you try to attract to invest in these water-related assets?
The sources that we attract are largely pension funds. We're money for both public and state pension plans as well as corporate pension plans. Mm-hmm. Our investors generally are long-term capital, generally, in many cases, could be the employees or the pension systems of employees of a state or a company operating in the state. What is really interesting, and this is where issues that we're facing, is how do you finance this in places where there may not be a pension system? So ultimately, the lack of underinvestment in the developing world, it varies by region. Europe has done a pretty good job of investing in these assets. I'd say depend, you know, Northern Europe better than Southern Europe. The United States, we are a third world country when it comes to our water infrastructure. There is a tremendous lack of investment, and we all know that there's been a lack of investment in infrastructure generally in the United States. I don't know if it's cultural, but these are job-creating necessary investments that do improve economic returns for, you know, cities and everybody. So
it's not very sexy, though. I mean, I think a lot of politicians shy away from it because it doesn't get a lot of buzz.
Well, it doesn't get a lot of buzz, but unfortunately, the only way to get the water industry to invest, particularly when it's government-owned, is through lawsuits, EPA fines, or in very dire circumstances, you know, tragedy.
Right.
Nobody wants to see it happen. You know, we see it as being economically stimulative. The problem, and there has not been necessarily as much innovation in the sector as we would like. I think we have a cultural, particularly in the U.S. and some of the Western Europe, we think there's technological fixes to everything.
Right.
Yeah, well, there's no app that's going to fix this problem. There are apps that will make it better to measure, easier to measure. We'll be able to do different things. But ultimately, we've got business, you know, we have business model innovation that is needed. But look, it's very exciting. This is a very solvable problem. it will be solved because, quite frankly, the alternative is Cape Town or, you know, Sao Paulo or Brazil, which got less press but is a much bigger city. It was within literally 60 days of running out of water.
What are they doing down there to solve that, or how are they addressing that, or how are they addressing Cape Town and Iran and Yemen and all those things?
You know, Cape Town, they obviously are addressing it through curtailment of consumption.
Yeah.
So people down to, you know, 13 gallons a day, which the average toilet here flushes a gallon and a half. Mm. And those are the efficient toilets. Ultimately, what you need to do is you need to plan, and you have to be thinking 5 years. You had to be thinking about this 5 years ago. The immediate solution for Cape Town would be investment in more mobile desal. It would be costly, but, you know, it would obviously have a direct benefit. In Sao Paulo's case, they made some investments to improve their access to different reservoirs. They put in some piping and, you know, they've improved their investment during the downturn, but they also were bailed out by the fact that it started raining.
Well,
and hopefully
that'll
be what happens in Cape Town too.
Uh-huh.
But a city that we always like to point to in the United States, which has done a very good job of sort of managing its water needs, is San Diego. So to your earlier question, in the state of California, all the water for Southern California comes from Northern California. The state pumps an enormous amount of water down through some state, two large canal systems to get to Southern California. And San Diego being the furthest southernmost state, ultimately being the last city on, southernmost city, being the last city on the pipeline, so to speak, was always preyed upon economically. Because why would you move there? You might run out of water. So what they've done is they've consciously gone out and diversified their water supply. And where they were reliant 95% back in 1990 on a wholesale water supplier, they now have a fully diversified water supply portfolio, which includes desalinization. It includes reuse of wastewater. It includes agricultural water. It includes a whole host of investments in water supply, which we think are really going to be what you have to think about in the future if you're in a drought-prone area. So that is something which is going to require investment and forward thinking. And a lot of the water problems, unfortunately, people in the water world or the consumers of water tend to have a short memory. There was a drought last year, and we had a drought here in Connecticut 2 summers ago. Greenwich almost ran out of water. They had to pump water from Bridgeport to Greenwich.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Nobody knew that. If you drove down the Merritt Parkway, there was a black flexible pipe that ran the length of the highway. That was an episodic thing. Drought goes away. People forget about it. Problem solved. Unfortunately, problem isn't solved, and you need to be thinking long term. Tremendous opportunity. Ultimately, it's going to be about being realistic about what your consumption is. Can you grow, if you're in a water-stressed area, can you continue to grow within your means, your water means? And if you're sole supplied, you need to diversify away. And it also means more reuse. We think the term wastewater eventually will go away. And it'll be called, Singapore calls it new water. Some people call it found water, reclaimed water. We live in a constant loop of water. It's
Recycle it or something.
We need to change our habits. And unlike power, you know, people make a lot of analogies with electricity. Well, electricity, there's lots of sources of electricity, increasingly more and more coming from renewables. The prices of electricity are going down. Our consumption of electricity is not really trying to be more efficient, but generally it's not the gating factor. Whereas water, you're going to probably be consuming a lot less water in the future, but it'll be costing you a lot more on a per unit basis.
Two things I'd like to touch on. One is the technological advances to help us do that. And also the example of Germany brought up on how their per capita is so much lower and their costs are so much higher. But Besides just costs, what are they doing to use less water? What is it about their culture or their government programs or people's attitudes or whatever?
I have not lived in Germany. I mean, I've visited, but I would say there is a cultural attitude against waste generally. Mm-hmm. They tend to, one, the prices are about four times higher than what we pay here. Mm-hmm. Price is an obvious difference. Cultural sensitivity towards waste and efficiency. Other than that, I don't think they've had any, you know, they have technologically, they've made, as the water is more expensive, they have washing machines, which are more effective or efficient, dishwashers, et cetera. You know, I lived in Europe for 10 years. You know, we paid four times the price for gas that we pay here. Didn't mean our lives were that much different. We drove smaller cars and, you know, we took a lot more mass transit. So You adapt. I'd say from a technological point of view, you know, the most important thing is probably measuring how much water you use. Two, making sure that most systems leak 30-40%. So you can fix
30-40%. Really? That's
amazing. Most municipal systems leak that much. So that's an obvious fix. Unfortunately, you know, you have to reline pipes. You have, you know, there are ways to either replace pipes. You can reline many pipes, particularly on the sewage side, get relined as opposed to replaced. They put a sort of an epoxy filled liner inside the pipe that hardens and becomes a new skin on the inside. I think ultimately we're going to have much more. Right now we have big, I liken it to, you know, Rome. We have big hub and spoke systems where water is treated in a central point and then shipped great distance for you to consume it. And then you take a shower, you flush your toilet, and that water is then shipped back another great distance and treated at a centralized waste plant. Yeah. Well, maybe there are ways to do it in a more scalable and efficient way, including smaller treatment centers that are less distant, that are smaller, somehow incorporated into the community. And ultimately, maybe it'll be that the city delivers, or whoever your water supplier is, delivers you raw water to your house, and then you have a treatment system to take that water up to whatever quality as you bring it into your house. And then when it leaves your house, perhaps you treat it as it leaves the house and just gets put into a pipe that takes it over to, maybe it gets recharged back into the ground. You could look at a very decentralized system, which could operate differently. And the other thing that with water, which is sort of an issue which nobody wants to deal with, is stormwater.
Yeah.
So as we deal with more, I won't say climate change, but let's just say episodic weather events.
I like that term. That's great.
You know, you have, look, you have more flooding.
Right.
You have more need to manage some of these flood or these, you know, these weather events, and you need infrastructure to do that. The problem is it's not very sexy because it's episodic. You have to build it now at great cost, and you may need it once every 5 years.
Right.
But when you need it, you really need it.
It's like the generator, right? When the electricity goes out. Oh, I can get by, I can get by. And then 4 years later when the electricity goes,
Houston,
didn't buy that?
Yeah, I'm sure Houston would have liked to have had, you know, the biggest problem with changing climates is we're going to have more of these events. And unfortunately, a lot of expensive real estate is by the coasts. Most wastewater treatment plants are on the coast. And they can get easily overwhelmed in some ways. So we have to think about that.
That leads me to think about a huge sort of cultural shift that's required about the way that people think about this. And clearly, just statistics or scare tactics don't work. And it would seem that unless it hits somebody's pocket, they aren't going to make any real change quickly. Talk to me a little bit about how we are subsidizing water now, and maybe the government, the various local government entities, it could be towns or cities and states and counties and whatever, are going to change this. But There must be some thinking that's keeping that in place, right?
Well, there is. The cost to deliver water is basically the same. The actual physical water itself is not the big determinant of the cost. So, you know, if you live in the arid Southwest or if you live in New England, that, you know, the cost of the actual physical water, that's not what's driving your bill. The most of the bill is being driven by the power and the infrastructure to treat it and deliver it to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think greater recognition around that. You know, I think one of the things that is important to think about is what costs are avoided by having a proper water system. You know, this is particularly in developing worlds, but, you know, the healthcare savings that you make by having a properly functioning wastewater system. In some of these countries, WaterAid, we operate in 38 countries in all sorts of different developing world situations. You know, there's a big push, for example, to fight HIV. But if you're swallowing your HIV pills with polluted water, it doesn't really do you any good.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea is we're going to have to think about some of the externalities surrounding water that need to be paid for. It's not dissimilar from this notion of plastic. I'm going off topic here. But
no, but I think the metaphor is good.
But the fact is you buy a single serving something or other in a clamshell container that's going to last 100 years.
Right.
That externality is not being priced in. And ultimately we'll have to change. So, you know, what's going to be driving this? I think consumers are going to become more aware of the quality of the water systems that they get their water from. I think businesses will become more aware of, gee, if I move to this area, is there a high quality water system that I can base my system, you know, my business off of? That's obviously mostly a manufacturing entity. Agriculture is, like it or not, they're going to have to price water in as a material cost to their income statement.
Right. Huh.
And you know, justify, can we earn a return on it? And if not, maybe there's a better use for it. There is no magic solution other than information and awareness. And I think a certain positivity, because look, it's life-giving, it's essential. There's lots of solutions. And I think ultimately we need to figure out ways in which we can make people realize that paying $135 for a cable versus your $45 for water, there's maybe more life-giving, you know, life in the water than there is in the cable.
What?
We have
misplaced priorities. You mean my HBO isn't more important than the water that I need to drink?
You'll be unbundling your HBO anyway. We think ultimately, because there is, you know, you have this system where you cannot avoid living without water.
Right.
And ultimately, you will consume a lot less. Part of the cultural, your question about Germany and the United States, you know, one of the issues that we deal with in the United States is we use 60-70% of our potable water is used in outdoor irrigation.
Yeah. What happens in Germany? How do they do that there?
They don't have gardens like we do. They don't value their green lawns the way we do.
So it's
a lifestyle issue, and look, there'll be regional, you know, regional differences, and people are adapting. You know, the West continues to grow, as you pointed out, the Western United States. But they realize in some of the more forward-thinking states like Colorado, like Arizona, that they have to live within their means. And so if you are planning a development in any one of those states, you need to obtain an offsetting supply of water before you can get your permits.
And
I mean, it's just, it's, you know, it's basic sort of balancing your checkbook.
Right.
You know, and here, and I think in the Northeast, and I know you have a vast audience, so I don't know where they all are, but in the Northeast, our biggest problem is vast is wastewater. Is wastewater. A lot of people, you know, the big issue is going to be a lot of people on cesspools.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to get them off cesspools because cesspools are, they're not built forever. And in depending on where you live, it can provide an environmental and a health risk.
Cesspools like septic tanks and
septic
that sort
tanks,
of thing.
Cesspools, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be a need to get those people onto centralized systems. And in some places, it may not make sense that it's a big system. Maybe it's a little local system.
Mm-hmm.
But there are good things. Look, waste management, the whole wastewater, there are byproducts that come from it. You can generate electricity as a byproduct of some of the wastewater treatment. You can reuse that water. And there are some places which are finding that there are elements that you can extract from the water.
Hmm.
There's a lot of potential. We see it as an area which can, from an employment point of view, also create a fair amount of jobs as you put some of this unavoidable infrastructure back into some functioning order.
Some of the things that you're talking about make me think about the holistic pricing model, as you were alluding to and speaking
right.
to some degree, that the second and third order consequences, or in this case, the second and third order costs of some of the things that we do are not taken into account in the pricing structures, so that those extra costs are picked up somewhere else. And they almost subsidize that economic product, right?
Yeah, I think that's where we got to get to. Unfortunately, a lot of those costs are not necessarily, those externalities are not being priced.
Right, and until we do that, then we don't really have a realistic look at how we're spending our money and how we're impacting our systems, our environment, or whatever, and you allude to the point of pricing things to actually reflect their costs. I think that's going to be a big change for many places.
Yeah, the big problem is governments are bankrupt. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not bankrupt, but they cannot spend any more. We also see that the political process is bogged down somewhat in that there's a lack of willingness to change certain things. So I think we're going to have to see where the financing and the will to change comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, we as consumers actually have an unbelievable amount of power. Witness how corporates have changed some of their behaviors. And I know
True.
That people vilify corporates, but actually corporates are the most likely to change. They're certainly more likely to change than governments. We think that pricing in these unrecognized costs is going to become a bigger thing. You look at, what's going on right now with the opioids, there's very large lawsuits which are going to come out of this whole terrible crisis, which hopefully will be used for treatment.
Yeah.
There was
problem.
That's a terrible consequence.
Oh, horrible. Yeah.
And I wouldn't say it's an externality. It's a direct cause or direct effect. I think plastics, to me, are another one. I think, we're going to see, ultimately there could be some ramifications of carbon. The fact that mm-hmm. people produce carbon. Carbon will be priced,
mm-hmm.
and that will be financing perhaps some of the reductions of carbon and could be financing some of the impacts of carbon. But water is one which is probably – perversely, because it's the most essential, it's an industry which has avoided a lot of innovation, a lot of new thinking. It's what gets us excited.
Well, I tell you, Mark, this has been great. You've really brought up so many fascinating things, and I hope people are as interested and as excited and maybe inspired to do something locally and talk to their town councils or their mayors or whatever to see what's going on and not necessarily vote against some municipal bond to help the water system.
Right. Ask for transparency. You want the full truth on how good is our system? How has it been maintained? What would happen? Because at the end of the day, it's all about risk
yeah.
management.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if I live by the coast, if another Sandy happens, if I live in a desert area, what happens if our supply gets imperiled somehow?
Right.
Because ultimately, it's those kinds of questions need will help people make decisions. And I think also the fact is people need to be aware that there is great opportunities to conserve. You look at Israel as a great example of a country which has managed to thrive in a very water-challenged area. And they've done it by pricing water, making it expensive to waste water, making sure that people reuse water, and you know, making sure that the agriculture they grow is extraordinarily efficient. Wow. It's expensive, but it works. So it gives us all cause that there are solutions out there. And quite frankly, there are jobs and careers and things that will create growth that come from a lot of this investment.
Well, this has been great. We could talk a lot more, but
we will.
We definitely will, and maybe we'll break this off and tackle certain pieces of this in the follow-up stuff.
Well, good luck to you, and thanks for including me in your...
This has been wonderful. I'm so appreciative. This has been great, and I hope people get a lot out of it. So, thank you very much. All right.
Yeah, thank you, Chip. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.